This is KZFR 90.1 FM Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Ecotopia, where we'll be discussing big agriculture's effort at repressing scholars and activists in the Central Valley. Our guests will be Dan O'Connell and Scott Peters, authors of In the Struggle, Scholars and the Fight Against Industrial Agribusiness in California.
The book tells about scholars and activists from the first part of the 20th century to today who studied the impacts of big ag on quality of life and water supplies and how that work was ignored, denied, or suppressed by their opponents.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Certified Farmers Markets, featuring three markets in Butte County. Year-round markets in Chico at the North Valley Plaza on Wednesday morning, and a third in Wall in downtown Chico on Saturday morning. There's also a seasonal market in Paradise on Tuesday morning. Chico Certified Farmers Market, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. And we're supported by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters, as we've said, and by Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920. Square Deal is celebrating over 100 years of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks and the fabric of your choice right here in Chico. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue. For details, see squaredealmattress.com. And we'll remind you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. We'll take a short break, listen to some music about Where Corn Don't Grow, then be back to talk with Dan O'Connell and Scott Peters about their book.
Sat on the front porch of that old gray house where I was born and raised, staring at the dusty fields where my daddy worked hard every day. I think it kind of hurt him when I said, "Daddy, there's a lot that I don't know. But don't you ever dream about a life where corn don't grow." He just sat there silent, staring at his favorite coffee cup. I saw a storm-mixed emotion in his eyes when he looked up. And he said, "Son, I know it's yours. Turned and walked back in the house. I was only 17 back then, but I thought that I knew more than I know now. I can't say he didn't warn me, the city life's a hard road to hoe. Ain't it funny how a dream can turn around? There's dusty fields no matter where you go.
dusty fields wherever you look. Corn don't grow. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. I'm Stephen Chudy. Our guests today are the authors of a new book titled In the Struggle, Scholars and the Fight Against Industrial Agribusiness in California. The writers of this book tell the stories of eight scholar activists from the early 20th century to today and how those people have used their studies to fight agribusiness. There are a lot of grim stories in this book about how various groups have fought to suppress this work, including big ag, politicians, the media, and even universities.
I'm Susan Chudy, and among the topics we'll discuss is Westlands and other water districts' acre-per-vote constitution, which, as they say, undermines democratic principles, and especially relevant as a topic here in Butte County, as Butte County activists are fighting the Tuscan Water District's proposal, which advocates the same sort of undemocratic plan.
We'll also mention at the close of the show there's a public workshop coming up on managing groundwater in the Butte sub-basin. So all of this comes together. Scott Peters is a professor in the Department of Global Development at Cornell University and former co-director of a national consortium of over 100 colleges and universities that's called Imagining America, Artists and Scholars in Public Life. And we'll ask Scott about that a little bit later in the show.
And Dan O'Connell is executive director of the Central Valley Partnership, which is a network of unions, environmental organizations, and community groups in the San Joaquin Valley. And we'll also be asking Dan about his work a bit later. Both are deeply committed to moving research out of the ivory tower and into the communities of our world. Welcome, Dan and Scott.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It's great to have you.
This book evolved from collaborative you both did at Cornell. Please tell us how it came about. Maybe you can just let us hear your voices, Dan or Scott.
And then introduce yourself.
This is Dan. I guess I'll go first. You know, it is deeply a collaboration between Scott and I. Scott was my major professor as I did this study and a mentor. Was a mentor and is a mentor. Now we're collaborators, as it should be, as you grow as a student. So it's great to be with him. I'll just add one thing, one additional point. This book is, you could think of it as a long-distance relay across time where scholars are passing off the fight as it arcs ahead of them, and they don't get an opportunity to finish the solving the problem that's in front of them. But, you know, Scott and I are the most recent people to enter the river, as Trudy would say. It's great to be with you. Scott?
Yeah, so I am delighted. I was delighted when Dan reached out to indicate his interest in studying with me at Cornell. And I had long been focused on the history of the connection between American land-grant universities and democracy. And the study that Dan did for his dissertation uncovers and shows us a really powerful chapter in that history that is not over, but is continuing as we speak, not just in California, but actually across the whole country. So we began a collaboration when Dan came to our graduate program at Cornell and are continuing that right to the present.
We're both committed to land grant institutions as well. I taught at Michigan State for 21 years. Then Susan and I taught at University of Nevada, both land-grant institutions Susan for 17 years, though we haven't gotten out and been as active as you two have been. The book tells the stories of eight scholars. I think I prefer to call them activists who do research or activists who really know what's going on. We can't cover all eight of these scholars in the interview, and listeners, read the book. It's published by New Village Press in New York. But let's start with Walter Goldschmidt. He was born in 1913, died in 2010. Dan, you had an opportunity to interview him before his death. Who was he? What was the study that he did, and what did he learn?
So I think Walter Goldschmidt is the entryway for many scholars who know that there's a problem with industrial agribusiness and yet haven't really found a way to articulate that. So, you know, the Arvindai-Numa study is that entryway and was for me. As I finished my graduate work with a master's degree in Davis in International Ag Development, professor handed me As You Sow. And what confronts you as a young student when you first engage and are introduced to the Arvind Ainuba study that was later published as You Sow, which is a biblical forewarning on what agribusiness does, is that it was censored straight off the bat by the Department of Agriculture, and then a follow-up study was suppressed. And I'd say the follow-up to all of that also is how the study was contextualized and received in academia itself. So over time, the study was never really permitted to be researched, and it took another 30 years to do the follow-up study to that was suppressed, a 25-town study that was going to follow the case study of Arvind Ainuba.
So what was the opposition to his study? Why was it censored or suppressed or whatever? What was he trying to do or show?
So the context is where the problems start arising for the study, in that the study was done for the Bureau of Reclamation by the Bureau of Ag Economics. The Bureau of Ag Economics at the time was a significant federal bureaucracy. It was potentially at the scale of cooperative extension system at the time. So it was significant. And so the government was going to research whether federal law should actually be followed. And that federal law was the 1902 Reclamation Law. And it stipulated two key factors, that farmers that signed contracts to get water from the Central Valley Project, so the research is being done in the context of the building of the Central Valley Project, all the dams and canals, the federal dams and canals were under this research, should the 160-acre limit and residency requirements of reclamation law be enacted? Almost all the farmers signed the contracts to receive that water. The law also stipulated that after 10 years, if you had land in excess of 160 acres, you were required to sell all that excess land at pre-water prices. So it would have enacted a land reform in the San Joaquin Valley and the Western United States under any jurisdictions where the reclamation law applied, and those were the buildings of all dams in the Western United States. But the most extreme example of unequal land ownership was the San Joaquin Valley, and therefore, when the research was done in Arvin, which is in Kern County, and Dinuba, which is in Tulare County, it demonstrated that the law should be implemented, that society benefits from small farmers rather than agribusiness.
And Goldschmidt also found in that research a relationship between who ran the town, whether it was big ag or local farmers. Could you talk a little bit about that aspect of the study?
So the study, when it's conducted, it does an empirical analysis. It's not perfect. Statistics is probably a higher level of scientific rigor. Mm-hmm. But he quantified the measures of community well-being. And Dinuba was surrounded by small farmers, and Arvin was surrounded by large land holdings. And so what happens is he measures numbers of doctors, numbers of parks, is the town incorporated or unincorporated, economics. The retail business in Dinuba was twice that of Arvin. So the farmers, entrepreneurs and business people themselves, were spending their money in the town. The money was circulating in the town, whereas the towns that were surrounded by absentee landowners that lived in urban centers far from Arvin, that money fled out of the town. So I often now simply state that capital and funds and money is like blood in a body, and you want it circulating as mm-hmm. many times as possible before it leaves. And finally, Goldschmidt also did a civic analysis. So how many PTAs and Boy Scout troops, and you know how the farmers were participating in the civic life, numbers of churches, numbers of denominations, those were also all in favor of Dinuba. So you find that both the economy erodes, but the civic life and the ability of democracy to sustain itself atrophies when you have an economy that leans towards feudalism rather than a diverse economy that's vested with multiple stakeholders.
So, could you break it down a little? I we're interested in Goldschmidt's view of the Bureau of Reclamation. And I mean, obviously, including the 160-acre limitation would help many, many, many farmers have more equitable access to water. But what are the downsides? What was progressive about the reclamation's purposes, and what was bad about it? Break it down.
Scott, did you want to go over this?
I'm sorry, did I flummox you?
The Reclamation Act was passed in the Teddy Roosevelt era, and actually Roosevelt was pretty fierce in his defense of that act. You know, at the core of it really is the question of what kind of society do we want to have?
Mm-hmm.
Do we want a society of very big, gigantic conglomerates that kind of run the show? Or do we want a society of lots and lots of people, as Dan has just mentioned, who have a stake in, because
right.
they're running an enterprise? And so when you look at the congressional debate when that act was passed, what you see is people saying, we are wanting to pass this because it actually embeds key values that we hold as a society in national policy. And the 160-acre limitation and the residency requirement both pointed in the direction of lots and lots of small-scale enterprises.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when the act was passed, the positive side could be viewed as the opportunity embedded in national policy of lots and lots of small enterprises mm-hmm. happening that would sort of, in a sense, even the playing field. I suppose if you want to look at the negative or the downside of
that's what I'm asking, because it seems positive to me.
Listen, there's a whole story that still continues today about what kind of agriculture do we need to feed the world, and, you know, mm-hmm. There's a history of a federal policy of cheap food.
Yes.
Actually, the founding of the land-grant university system was centered on the idea that science would enable us to produce cheap food, which mm-hmm. would make American industrial businesses competitive in the global marketplace. And that's almost a direct quote from Justin Smith Morrill, his speech mm-hmm. on the floor of Congress to pass the Morrill Act. And so you have these two things in tension with each other. The fueling of the industrial economy to make the nation competitive and to feed the growing millions of people with inexpensive food, and the ideals that our people associate with democracy
and
associate with equity.
Yeah, okay. I get it now.
I think one of the ways to look at this is, rather than look at reclamation purposes, is to look at reclamation values. The 160-acre limit wasn't initiated in 1902 when, by the way, Republicans were progressives in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Teddy Roosevelt and Howard Taft. This goes back to an era of the Homestead Act and the settler colonialism that happened in the Midwestern United States, which was also partitioned. That law passed in the middle of the Civil War by Lincoln, another progressive Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire Midwest was apportioned on 160-acre lots. And remember, about 40 years later, by, you know, the Industrial Revolution, it was those small farmers in the Midwest who were the most progressive folks in the United States. And it stayed that way for decades. So the Midwest, Kansas, was a seething, progressive, radical center in the United States mm-hmm. for years. And as you see agribusiness begin to consolidate the economy of the Midwest and acquire those farms, now you have Kansas probably being one of the most reactionary in the other states in the Midwest. So as we've lost the middle class or a diverse economy, you also lose the capacity for democratic engagement and life.
Mm-hmm. That's really insightful. That's really great.
I was going to tell you, I taught in Morrill Hall at Michigan State for 21 years, dedicated to Justin Morrill, and we took pride.
Every land grant has a Morrill Hall.
We have
one at Cornell.
Yeah.
Ours was demolished for a parking lot, but there you go. But could your book traces the decay of the 160-acre limitation. Could you review that history? How did it go away? And I'll just also inject, we have in our part of the world a number of big farms where cousins are in the trust, where nephews are in the trust, where family members all get a portion, and that's part of the runaround, as I understand it.
The law is lost over a period of 40 years, but as you read the book and where Paul Taylor comes in, mm-hmm. you realize, and here's the one of the most shocking aspects of this. Not only was the Arvind Inuba censored, but federal law, the reclamation law, this 160-acre limit, the research said it should be constituted. It was finally released through the Small Farms Committee in the Senate. So it wasn't, it did get out, and the law even was never implemented. And to realize that a major federal law was never implemented in any kind of sort of meaningful way. In 1958, the U.S. Supreme Court, citing Paul Taylor's Yale Law Review article, voted 9-0, stipulating, this is a decade or two after the dams have been constructed and the water is being delivered, that the law needs to be implemented. A 9-0 Supreme Court decision, it still wasn't implemented. Mm-hmm. And remember, that lawsuit, that Supreme Court case comes just as the state of California starts getting worried and is taking up the business of agribusiness and builds the State Water Project, which is not apportioned by acreage limitation or residency requirements. Mm-mm. And that's the enormous giveaway to the agribusinesses in Kern County, for instance. So you have the fact that what happens when we realize that not only can Congress pass a law and the Supreme Court uphold it with the highest level of unanimity, and then not to have it implemented. And that's where you start realizing how desperate and severe and extreme this problem is. And Paul Taylor warned that, you know, if there is a monopoly of land that is then sits upon a monopoly of water, that we're going to be in a very bad situation. And that's exactly the situation we have happening right now.
You mentioned Paul. Also, Ernesto Galarraza, you say that both he and Taylor experienced, quote, McCarthy-era harassment for their work. Who harassed them, and how was their scholarship challenged?
Taylor's harassed. It's interesting. For the book, we had to cut out quite a bit, but Taylor was asked to speak at Chico State. And after his talk at Chico, where he again talked about everything I'm telling you, he talked about it this was his cause celeb for decades after he retired. He suspects that somebody would just call the FBI during the era of McCarthy, and he was investigated by the FBI repeatedly. And it was important for Scott and I to situate Paul Taylor correctly. He is coming from the Midwest. He was a young lieutenant in the Marine Corps leading troops at Belleau Wood. Mm-hmm. And we opened Taylor's chapter with him leading troops at a battle that historically was devastating. The Marines fought extremely valiantly. And you hear Taylor fighting that in battle to open his chapter. And it was a prelude to what he confronts against the industrial agribusiness that he begins to face off on. But I suspect that just various people during an era that was extremely reactionary would inform on Taylor, and he was repeatedly investigated by the FBI and cleared repeatedly.
I have to say that the Paul Taylor story is particularly close to my heart, having grown up in Illinois and he grew up in Iowa. But I think it's important to see the kind of deep irony here. I mean, here's a guy who grew up in a small town in Iowa, went to the University of Wisconsin, and he actually volunteered to fight in World War I. Mm-hmm. He went to the president's office. He walked to the president's office at the University of Wisconsin before he was going to graduate to volunteer to sign up to join the battle, join the Marines in World War I. And then he ended up being gassed on the field, almost lost his eyesight. And wrapped around all of that was this fierce belief he had that they were, as Woodrow Wilson was saying, defending democracy. that they were trying to defend democracy against its destruction in that war. What he did is he took that same commitment onto the ground in California as he became a professor of economics, and he developed a very innovative way of doing research, which involved a partnership with his wife, Dorothea Lange, mm-hmm. the woman who became his wife in the 1930s. It included photography. Mm-hmm. It included a lot of on-the-ground observations and interviews, what we call ethnography. Mm-hmm. He was an economic ethnographer. So it's kind of ironic that when he starts picking up the battle to defend the Reclamation Act, which is supposed mm-hmm. to defend core American values of equality of opportunity and all those things, that the FBI shows up at his office and that he starts getting harassed and he starts getting seen as un-American. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's really
bizarre.
Quite,
yeah.
It's disturbing on one level, but the other level that's not disturbing is just the sheer admiration that you have for someone like him who spent countless hours. He talks, and we quote him in the book, talking about how he still remembers the heat of the pavement in Washington, D.C., because he wasn't just doing academic studies. He went to Washington, D.C., and he worked the corridors of Congress to build a constituency of support to support the Reclamation Act enforcement. And that's what all of these activist scholars, as mm-hmm. you've described them in this book, are doing, is that they're not sitting on campuses just doing studies and publishing them. They're jumping out into the world and getting involved and feeling the heat of the pavement.
How did the universities react to this work? Were they supportive? Did they leap to these professors' defense?
Well, you know, in a couple of the chapters, Paul Taylor's and also in Dean McCannell, who mm-hmm. is the one who picked up the retest of the Goldschmidt study, both of them were defended by their institution.
Okay.
Paul Taylor talks about how he was protected and defended by the president of Berkeley. And McCannell was also protected. And so in their case, that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
This book, it's important to realize, I'm sort of coming back to how you introduced this book, and us, it's important to realize that 8 scholars that we show or look at in this book, only 4 of them, half of them, were university employed scholars.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of them were working independently out in communities. Ernesto Galarza being one of the most, the sort of fiercest one, and we should talk about him and
yes.
let Dan talk about him. But you had people who weren't just in universities. You had people who were out in the community, building knowledge and testing it and publishing from their work.
To this point, we've largely been talking about white guys that have existed.
Yes.
Walter Goldschmidt
yeah.
was an anthropologist
right.
at UCLA. Galarza enters us into a different kind
yeah.
of fight. And
yes.
you have to understand, he actually was on the offense. He never was on the defense. And so when I often am speaking with young organizers of color here in the San Joaquin Valley, I don't point them to Goldschmidt or Taylor. I point them to Galarza.
Mm-hmm.
Page 90, a subsection of his chapter called Engage the Enemy. When he's talking to Chicano study students at Berkeley in the 1970s, Ernesto Galarza was a farm worker himself. He was under no preconceptions that the world was fair. He miraculously made his way to get a BA at Occidental College, a master's at Stanford, and a PhD from Columbia. And with that, he does not, and he always did, resist going into the, quote, cemetery that he thought universities were. Rather, he takes a job as a farm labor organizer and walks right into the valley and attacks Giorgio Farms, that is the agribusiness that surrounds Arvin, which only a few years earlier, in the mid-1940s, Goldschmidt researched, and 5 years later, Galarza is now leading a strike against the largest agribusiness in the United States, and they do attack him. He's a union organizer. They go after his union, and the book goes into great detail, and he chronicles in about 4 books how he's how they attack him, how he fights back, the battles that he rages. He is organizing in an era of braceros. The braceros were used as strike breakers. They lowered the wages across the board in the standards of living for all workers, not the fault of those workers themselves, but a systemic and institutional cause of what happens when you have such an imported labor system, decreasing wages and leaving the organizing potential of folks vulnerable. And so he ends up fighting for 10 years to undermine the justifications of Public Law 78, which he successfully does. But by that time, his union is completely destroyed. He was in a hospital bed for 3 months with sheer exhaustion after his 10 to 12 years of fighting here in the Valley. And yet, I will say that in 1963, the Braceros program is discontinued by Congress. And by 1964, you start seeing the UFW emerge with Cesar and Dolores, and they start winning contracts with farmers because I think the ground was set with Galarza having laid that with both organizing workers prior to that, but for sure discontinuing that federal law that was unhelpful to labor organizing at the time. So Galarza is going out of his way to attack agribusiness, and he uses it as a way to do his research to find out and investigate them as well.
So he's mainly fighting the labor practices and supporting unions. Is he supporting small farms as well? Is he taking on that aspect of the fight against agribusiness?
I think it was all tactics and strategy, same as Taylor. All of these people are, you know, tactics are methods, if you think of it in research, and strategies are theories. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that he was always geared towards what was most leverage in the fight. I will say, and it's not in the book, it's not even in the dissertation, that in Galarza's papers in the library, in the archives in Stanford, you'll find the contract that farmers were made to sign from reclamation. That's in there, a blank contract, and he's listed right after that all of the farmers that are above 160 acres, which is almost all of them. So he is ready to implement reclamation law. He just never had the opening, which Paul Taylor was trying to open in a way at the university and in jurisprudence and law.
Right, right. And so nobody could ever do that. Nobody could ever implement that law.
How is that, Susan, if you really think of it? How is it that federal law is not implemented?
Well.
Well, I think, you know, this
power,
is
money.
Is something you said earlier, you said something about the demise of the Reclamation Act, and I think it's more appropriate actually to think, and what we see and trace in the book is really the story is about the hijacking of the Reclamation Act and the corruption of American politics, because what happened was the big agribusinesses, and they found essentially lackeys in Congress who would do their bidding for them and who would help them make sure that the law would just be ignored and set aside and not reinforced. So they were actually doing organizing, those people. And Taylor and others were doing organizing at the same time. Taylor was able to push the envelope so that it took 40 years after he started working on that for it to be overturned. But it would have been overturned much earlier if Taylor and all of the people that he was working with weren't doing the organizing they were doing.
Right. Who was Big Ag here at this point? Who was pushing all of the, like, pushing the FBI and buying up all of the land and creating these conglomerate huge farms?
You know, it's really hard to put your finger on an institution, but in that era, there was one called the Associated Farmers. But you almost look at this as a cultural formation. And this is one of the aspects of Galarza's work, that how do you research and find out who the enemy is?
Right.
And it's operating on many different levels and in a cultural frame as well.
We want to segue a little bit to the Westlands Water District. You describe it, if I'm not misinterpreting, it's kind of a prototype of the big ag-controlled water purveyor. And we've corresponded briefly. I know you're following efforts in Butte County to establish the Tuscan Water District, which would operate on a vote per acre basis. You have a different term for it, but we'd welcome your comments first about Westlands, also your views on what's going on in Butte County with Tuscan.
So I've been following what's happening in Tuscan in Butte County for a few years now, and it's come to my radar because, and I would say anyone up in Pico and Butte County and Northern California should read the book to understand and see how Westlands behaves, to really begin to understand what they're going to be putting in place and will be very difficult to crowbar back. Water districts are special districts. They are basically forms of government. They can take on public debt. They can sometimes accrue levy fees or even taxes, depending on how they're constituted. And especially in unincorporated areas, they can provide services to the community. It's sometimes shocking for people who think, and in the California Constitution, it is stipulated that it's one person, one vote, and most people think that that's the standard for democracy. In property weighted water districts, the votes are apportioned by how many acres you have, and sometimes what the dollar value of the acreage you have. Mm-hmm. So if you have 1 million acres or 100,000 acres, you have 100,000 votes or 1 million votes. If you have no acres, you have 0 votes. Mm-hmm. The Westlands, I sometimes say, it's a feudalistic society, because probably 70 or 80% of farm labor there is undocumented and extremely vulnerable and abused by these same growers. Mm-hmm. These growers, again, have no problem voting for Trump, who's going to undermine their own labor supply. The cynicism of these folks is off, and the hypocrisy is off the charts. Mm-hmm. In the Westlands, you often see signs saying water created drought, which is exactly the opposite narrative of what has happened. The Congress enabled the desert to bloom there, and mm-hmm. bloom only and extraordinarily in their benefit, and to great environmental and personal costs for those workers, adverse costs. And so the Westlands in the book presents itself as the representative, the best symbol of what agribusiness is and is acting. Bernhardt, who was chief counsel, I think, of the Westlands, that went on to be the Department of Interior Secretary. Mm-hmm. So this is the amount of power that the Westlands is garnering now in the United States. We have Devin Nunes and Kevin McCarthy with their incredible misinformation lies spewed to the folks down here. And so, you know, this does not stop. So I would recommend the book to everyone up in Northern California that is looking at why in the world would you want to empower a handful of people to control your water.
Yeah, this has been a big fight here. Steve and I have both kind of been part of the conversation. And we keep saying the same thing. You know, why would you want a few big rich guys to make decisions about all of you who think? One of the things that the Tuscan Water District says it's going to do is create water. And I'm really, really kind of didn't know that they had that kind of, you know, heavenly connection. But, you know, we're in drought. We're in scarcity. We're in climate change. They're not creating water. There's going to be a scarcity of water. And who do you suppose is going to get first grab at it?
Yeah. So they're going to create water for themselves.
That's it.
We are encouraged. The community here is alert. It took a while. There are some very good groups working actively. Unfortunately, we sat through the County Water Commission hearings last week. The commission voted 6-3 to support Tuscan. It'll then go to the supervisors, and we're expecting a similar vote based on the conservative nature of that group. Then it will go to LAFCO for final approval, and we're very nervous about that. The good news is that there are some smart lawyers thinking about these issues. Tuscan will not come into being overnight. It will be tied up in the court for years to come before it can do any damage.
So, speaking of lawyers, mm-hmm. I just want to point out that on page 308, which is the next to the last page of the book, there is a photograph of Janaki, mm-hmm. who is the scholar we conclude with, who just got a law degree at UC Davis. Mm-hmm. She's sitting there looking at a Westlands Water District map.
Yes.
The ballast map of the Westlands Water District. And what that photograph communicates is the is one of the avenues of resistance and power and struggle. What she is doing, you might think about it as investigative journalism, mm-hmm. right? She's going and she's getting the maps and she's investigating them and she's looking for and finding files and getting access to the files and she's putting the pieces together. And this is what all of the scholars in this book were doing
yes.
and were committed to.
That map that map that Janaki's looking at there, she went up to Sun Mountain, which was the place that Ballas went to live. Ballas was a famous photographer trained by Dorothea Lange and others of the UFW. Many of the most famous pictures of Cesar, many of them are from George Ballas. And he was a documentary filmmaker as well. But I often say that that map there is a modern-day Guernica, a forewarning of a crime, of a travesty, of a slaughter of democracy. And she went up to Sun Mountain, found it. She copied it in color, and I have it here at my house. Yeah. She put back the original. And I often bring it with me and show people. And George Ballas started National Land for the People. He was the one that sued Reclamation to implement the law in the 1970s that finally ended up with overturning the law. But George Ballas won that case, and it was going on forward. And so George Ballas from Fresno fought against these kind of property-weighted systems and industrial agribusiness as an activist in collaboration with scholars. And we work together still as activists and scholars. Scott and I will tell you, this book is absolutely essential for people to understand what's going to happen in your community if Tustin mm-hmm. goes through.
I want to read. I checked the index for Westlands and the topics covered in the index. This is not a complete list, but they have their fingers in education, farm size, irrigable lands, harm caused by income, housing and poverty, and manipulation of water prices. And, of course, they've got a heavy hand in the former twin tunnels now yeah. to become a single tunnel, and they will be a major financial supporter of that if it goes ahead. We do want to transition. We haven't had enough time to talk about Jagannath. She's brilliant, doing fabulous work, another exemplar. But we did want to talk a little bit about your work. Scott, you're the former director of the Imagining America Project, and mm-hmm. we're fascinated by the integration of art, scholarship, and activism. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about it, please.
Sure, and I'll say that I was the director, co-director from 2012 to 2017, and we transitioned the national office to UC Davis. So it is now in California, and mm-hmm. Erica mm-hmm. Kolarinas is now the director. She's a fabulous, wonderful scholar, very much in the tradition of this book and that whole long legacy of people. Imagining America is a representation of a growing interest and movement, particularly of young scholars who are going to universities, people like Dan, actually, who are going to universities and who are wanting to study and learn and get degrees, but they don't want to fit into the traditional academic kind of pattern mm-hmm. or job. And one of the things that's most important for people to understand, and actually Trudy Wisherman in this book is kind of the exemplar of this, is that the social science that people like Dean McCannell do that are featured in the book is critically important. It's a kind of knowledge production that is brought to the political policymaking world, like Goldschmidt did with his study. It's very important. But there's a whole different kind of work that's done from people that come from the arts and humanities. And actually, Paul Taylor was very interestingly interweaving that. When he was using photography, when he was using the kind of stories of the migrant labor that he was documenting and looking at, he was not doing social science in the traditional sense. Mm-hmm. He was using different ways of knowing that involved visual representations of things and moves into poetry and art. So Imagining America represents the fact that lots of people who are in those fields understand that there's a great power in their ways of working, in the way that they produce knowledge and the way that they help people see things and understand truth. So Imagine America emerged out of a kind of bold agitation in people of those fields to say, we need to come together and support each other, those of us who are interested in doing that kind of politically engaged scholarship and research, the activist scholarship that you define. So that's what Imagine America is. It actually came out of the Millennial Council that President Clinton established. Hillary Clinton was actually the chair of that council. It was established in 1999, and it's really going strong under Erica's leadership and the team that she has based at UC Davis. So that's a glimpse of what Imagine America is, and it certainly fits with my own passion and commitment as a historian to bring the work and tools of history into the political arena. History is very powerful and important. Again, it's different from social science, but it has its own special things to contribute.
Mm-hmm. You can check it out, listeners, at imaginingamerica.org. And I want to mention, next week on this show, we'll be talking with Christina Conklin. She's co-author of An Atlas of Disappearing Places. And she's an artist. She salvages kelp from the sea, thins it down, and paints maps, which illustrate her book. It's a remarkable use of art to heighten the data. Dan, you are very busy as executive director of the Central Valley Partnership. Your list of collaborators is very long indeed. Tell us a little bit about what you do and how you sleep at night.
I don't sleep well as I did when I was younger, but you know, the Central Valley Partnership was formed in about 2012 as an effort to bring labor unions and environmental groups together. I don't know if people realize how divergent some of those interests are, and yet I'd say 60 or 70% of the time there's an alignment of values there. So, and there had been a tremendous amount of infighting in Fresno. You know, most of my headaches and consternation happened just trying to get people to get along. And the partnership is founded upon finding common ground and setting aside differences. We incorporate in 2016, the year of Trump's election, and at that year, we moved to a regional posture. I always say that you're not going to accomplish what you need if you're not naming it correctly. And the object of change that we're engaged in here is not Fresno-centric. Fresno is kind of like New York City. You know, everyone hears New York, they think of the city, but there's a huge state there as well. Fresno is a major metropolitan area, maybe the most central and strategic, and yet the object of change is these eight counties in the San Joaquin Valley. So, you know, we're engaged here. We're dedicated. Our mission is to achieve social, racial, environmental, and economic justice in the San Joaquin Valley. And we take that in unapologetic terms and with a fierce commitment. You know, we do monthly meetings, so anyone can join our meetings, and it'll give you a view into the progressive movement. We're explicit about our we're nonpartisan because we're nonprofit, but our values are explicit and progressive. Progressive values. Values in the public interest. Simple enough, huh?
That's
We build a civic infrastructure here. We're doing nonpartisan candidate training. We're doing governance trainings for newly elected young folks of color. We have, with UC Merced's Community Labor Center, a summit on the Central Valley that should be happening in the winter of this year, depending on COVID. And it's well underway, the change here. I might worry and fret about what's happening in the Midwestern United States. I'm optimistic and positive about California, especially our extraordinarily diverse agricultural regions like Chico, like Fresno, like Visalia. Young people of color are absolutely taking hold, and they've witnessed their parents and grandparents walk out the door every day and be abused. A system of a racialized oppression is in place and delineated in this book for people to map and therefore attack. And that's what we're doing. But I'm actually just helping out a movement that's well underway. And I think what's happening here with the diverse, the multiracial, intergenerational, gender-inclusive movement that we have here is potentially a model for other places. Mm-hmm. So we're underway here and fighting in line with this river of history that Scott and I tell in the book.
You're clearly following, too, your own axioms. I was surprised. There's a very short list of axioms in the conclusion, perhaps a dozen or so of them for the politically engaged person. One really surprised me. Your lead axiom, practice supersedes theory. That's heretical in some academic circles. Could you justify that and explain how it works in your work, both with Imagining America and the Central Valley Partnership?
Well, listen, I can jump in and say I spend a lot of my time doing oral histories of practitioners who are on the front lines of community change work. And if we in the academy think that we are the theorists, the leading edge theorists, we really need to check ourselves. Because it's the people on the front lines who are fighting battles every day and learning from their experiences who are the building and testing and refining theory. And so for me as a historian, I have to do oral history with these practitioners in order to develop theory, because theory comes from their stories, hard won from their experience. You know, that might be countercultural in the academic world, because academics think that they invent theory based on their ivory tower reflections. People still think that. But not everybody in the academy is oriented that way. And those of us who are awake to realities in the world know that we would be crazy if we followed that model.
We also read the importance of Dean McCannell's work when he did the retest of Goldschmidt's finding. He used macro statistics, big number crunching, as I understand it, of the sort that is used frequently now. And that kind of number crunching does validate ethnography and some of the other kinds of research that traditionally, at least in our experience, many academics frown upon.
Yeah.
I just want to insert something here about practice and theory. I think that sometimes practitioners are not highly aware of their theory. And so I think talking about, you know, what these are your practices, what does that mean that you believe about stuff, or what are the principles that you can extrapolate from that are communicable and shareable?
That happens at the core of the best kind of action research that happens.
I agree.
When community members come together and some scholars choose to sit at those tables and be engaged with them, and those kinds of questions are posed, and collectively people work through their reflections, and they come to be aware and conscious of the lessons they've learned from their experience, and they refine those lessons, and they go test them doing some more action.
Scholarship isn't about intelligence. It's about care, and it's about values. And so, you know, the name of a book, In the Struggle, orients to where Scott and I are directing, and we want, in an era of existential crisis and climate change, these institutions to function better. And they have in the past, by the way. They get better and they get worse. Now, if ever was the time, it's to get in and grapple with what's happening, and we have to. If you, and this is from David Greenwood, I believe, is the anthropologist at Cornell, right, Scott?
Yep.
He was the one that first, you know, I read and sat in a course by him, and he once said, you know, campus-based scholarship can be, is useful, but it can also be vulnerable to speculation and conjecture because it's so far from where the problems are occurring. And so there's multiple alignments here that show that if you are one of those young people that are trying to understand your world and why you're poor and why your family is struggling, and so often the poor are blamed for their own misery, and it's not true.
No.
And this book will show you there are systems and institutions and structures that are working to put you in that place and keep you there, and that we need to fight back. And that those people that most often experience those problems are the most vested in problem solving. You do not need letters after your name to be a scholar. Knowledge is not neutral. It's positioned. It's situated. It's political in every single way. There's Paul Taylor talks about the facts carrying weight. The facts in certain contexts will cause certain other problems to hit you in the face, which he found out about. So, you know, I often encourage young people to go to university, or I talk to them about the theory in this book. I find that the young people of color that have experienced these problems firsthand, or working class folks in general, understand this book in a lot of ways easier than secure middle class folks.
I just want to say, that was a great closing statement. Yes. Really articulate and really clear and really important for academic people to understand. I'm sorry, we got to wind up.
Yeah, the 8 scholars in the book are inspirational, but what you've just said,
yes,
Scott and Dan, mm-hmm, is equally important and inspirational. The book is In the Struggle, Scholars and the Fight Against Industrial Agribusiness in California. It's from New Village Press in New York. We strongly urge you to get a copy of it. Read it cover to cover. There's much more than we were able to discuss today. Thank you, Scott and Dan, for being with us today on Ecotopia.
Keep up the fight. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You too. Bye.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain. You're gonna fall.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. We just had a caller ask us to repeat the title, In the Struggle, Scholars and the Fight Against Industrial Agribusiness in California. Also want to mention that in 2 weeks, we'll be replaying our interview with Mark Erics. He was the author of Dreamt Land, that talks about where a lot of that agricultural abuse originated in the San Joaquin and the Central Valley. That'll be 2 weeks. His book is The Dreamt Land. We want to tell you a little bit, there'll be a public workshop, Managing Groundwater in the Butte Subbasin. This will take place on September 20th. It's 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. It's live in person in Biggs at 3016 6th Street, but it'll be online via Zoom, and there is information. It's various places on the internet. You can get the Zoom link. You'll learn more about local groundwater management in the basin. You'll receive an overview draft of the GSA plan and opportunities to get involved.
We want to remind you, too, that the Butte Environmental Council is holding its Bidwell Park and Chico Creeks cleanup. That's a yearly event. I think this is something like 43. It's September 18th and 19th. That's this coming Saturday and Sunday. I think that you can, and it's from 9 to 12, both mornings. You may still be able to register online at becknet.org/beck. Hyphen cleanup, but you can also just show up a little before 9 at Hooker Oak Park and participate in the cleanup.
Coming up in just a few minutes, it's North State Give and Take with Bobby Tryon. She'll be talking with reps from Butte County Home Share, Sierra Schmidt and Catherine Karkoff. Their project is called Heart and Home. And then at 6:30, it's Ginger Nichols with Radioactive. We're just going to keep talking for about 40 seconds.
No, you're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. You can visit our website for notes and recordings of recent programs, plus an ever-growing list of resources provided by our guests. That's at Ecotopiakzfr.com. We also welcome your comments and suggestions. Send us an email at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com.
Up next is North State Give and Take, and it's made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothes and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers in the heart of downtown Chico. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 30 years and is located at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling the Cotton Party at 893-4923 and by the Printed Image, providing screen printing and embroidery in Chico since 1980. The Printed Image is open Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and by appointment. More information by calling them at 898-9525. Bobby Tryon. On this show, we speak with movers and shakers and giver and takers in our community. So stay tuned for some pre-recorded interesting interviews on North State Give and Take every Tuesday at 6. Today, I'm going to interview Sierra and Catherine from Butte County Home Share.